If you go almost anywhere in the world, you're bound to see houses with lawns. The lawns may cover a small yard or go for what seems like miles. Most likely, they will be mowed close to the ground and consist only of leaves of grass. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Salwa Khan. The question is why? Why must we all have perfectly manicured green lawns, which require huge amounts of water, fertilizer, herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides? In addition to being perfectly boring, lawns and their requirements harm biodiversity and wildlife, and the machines used to cut them contribute large amounts of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. My guest, Danae Wolf, is a conservation educator, photographer, and author of a book entitled Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard, in which she explores our cultural obsession with lawns and encourages challenging the norm and creating wilder, more resilient gardens that welcome and support the natural ecosystem. I asked Wolf how she became interested in conservation.
Yeah, my background as a conservation educator and photographer really begins when I was a young girl around the age of 12. And my parents bought me my first camera. This was, of course, a film camera at this time. And I became really enamored with photographing plants and flowers in particular. At the time, I really hated insects. I had severe arachnophobia, could not even look at photos of spiders without cringing and shaking in fear. But it was about 10 years afterward when I was in college. My parents gifted me one year for Christmas my first macro lens. And all of a sudden, I went from photographing plants to actually beginning to see and notice and observe all of the insects and spiders that had been visiting these plants that I spent the last year, 10 years photographing. And I just had ignored because of this fear that I had. All of a sudden, it kind of opened up this whole new world for me. At the same time, I was getting my undergraduate degree in environmental studies. So I was learning about, really for the first time in my life, local ecology and the impacts that really humans have on local streams and rivers and land and the decline of biodiversity. Climate change was really coming into mainstream conversation at that time too. So that education paired with this newfound interest of photographing insects kind of kickstarted this sort of innate desire and passion for educating people about insects in particular and their importance and what we could do in our home environments to help support them. So it kind of created the foundation for me thinking differently about my home landscape when we bought our first home about 15 years ago. And, I've spent the last 15 years or so teaching others what they can do differently in support of wildlife and the planet as well.
And in your book, The Grass Isn't Greener, you take aim at grass and more specifically lawns and the many environmental issues that come with that. Now, one thing a lawn requires is a lot of water. What problem does that present?
Yeah, water, I think water is often viewed as this highly renewable resource, right? Like, oh, we can just clean water and we can desalinate the oceans to, you know, come up with cleaner drinking water. But the reality is that's a very energy intensive process. And if we just thought more deliberately and thoughtfully about our waterways and how our personal home landscapes contribute to the pollution and degradation of waterways, we could eliminate the need for all of this really energy heavy, you know, processing of water. Water is becoming a really scarce resource. Now, I live in the Midwest near the Great Lakes. I live just south of Lake Erie, and we have this incredible resource of water like right at our fingertips. And more we're hearing in the news about, you know, water is becoming a scarcer and scarcer resource, especially in arid regions of the country like out west. And what is that going to look like for those of us that have easy access to fresh water in particular. So things are really scary. And again, lawns are incredibly resource intensive, plants to grow. In fact, they're the heaviest irrigated crop in the United States, which is mind blowing. We have 40 million acres of turf grass, and the great majority of that is tied up in our residential home landscapes by way of turf grass lawns. And we're irrigating them, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're wasting water resources, we're fertilizing them, which further contributes to water degradation when it rains, and those fertilizers, the phosphorus, runs off into streams and rivers and into places like Lake Erie, where they contribute to harmful algal blooms and the sort of the creation of dead zones, ecological dead zones in these, what should be really biodiverse ecosystems. So we're kind of losing sight of the bigger picture, all in an effort to maintain a carpet of grass.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan. I'm here today with Danae Wolf. She's a conservation educator, a macro insect photographer, and author of a book entitled Grass Isn't Greener. We're talking about lawns. So one thing that a lot of people do, you talked about fertilizer, but they also use a lot of herbicides and fungicides to kill what they consider undesirable. How does that affect nature?
This affects nature in huge ways, and it is a main contributing factor to the loss of biodiversity, particularly in these suburban and urban landscapes. So, we can talk about pesticides, and when I use the term pesticide, I'm more holistically referring to everything from herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, you name it, rodenticides, basically any chemical designed to target and kill what you mentioned as a non-desirable. And we have a lot of non-desirables in our home landscapes, right? We want to attract beautiful things like butterflies, but we don't want the wasps. We want to attract maybe pollinating bees, but maybe we don't want things like moths, or we don't want caterpillars, which is funny because caterpillars, of course, grow into those beautiful butterflies that we want. And caterpillars feed birds. If you love birds, we have to have the caterpillars and other insects because those are the primary food source of young birds in particular. So we have this, I think, very skewed system as humans of applying sort of preferential treatment and value to species out there. There are the ones that we love and that we want to attract to our landscapes. And then there are a host that we actively try to deter. And it's not even just the chemical pesticides that contribute to that loss of biodiversity, but we're also using really unethical ways of sort of dispatching a variety of undesirables. We're using glue traps, for example, and some of these things are just really, really terrible to have out there in the landscape. So redefining what we consider to be beautiful and, rethinking what's desirable versus undesirable, I think is really foundational to kind of kickstarting an interest and active participation in just a more ecologically minded gardening approach.
As a macro photographer, you see insects up close. Most people, when they see an insect, just want to kill it. Why should we care about insects?
Insects play a foundational role in ecosystems the world over. And we often hear about the power of pollination, right? And we talk about pollinators, we really tend to narrow the conversation around bees. Honeybees get a lot of attention here in the US. And it's interesting because honeybees are actually a non-native species here in the United States. And being non-native, when we talk about the conservation and protection of bees, what we're really referring to are those species of native bees that have lived here for millennia and co-evolved alongside native plants, and our pollinators that are contributing out to sort of the pollination of plants in nature. Honeybees are wonderful pollinators and important pollinators in an agricultural sense, but they're really kind of livestock. They shouldn't really be a part of that like native bee conservation conversation. But beyond pollination, insects play so many different roles. And by the way, bees are certainly not the only pollinator. Wasps pollinate, beetles and butterflies and moths pollinate. And then we have incidental pollinators too. We have, spiders that spend their days looking for prey on flowers. They also are pollinators, certainly not as efficient as many of our bees, but they're out there doing the hard work nevertheless. But then we have the power of insects in things like predation. So this would be the spiders, the wasps, the little ambush bugs and assassin bugs. There's such a beautiful diversity of predators out there that are kind of taking care of what we as humans often consider pests. So these would be things like the aphids or the white flies or the things that maybe impact, the beautiful plants that we're trying to grow in our garden or the food that we're trying to grow in our veggie garden. There's like a wealth of little predators out there that are keeping that sort of balance in check to ensure that our plants can thrive, which is great. Insects also contribute to things like soil aeration and, of course, decomposition and a number of really, really beneficial ecosystem services. Without insects, a lot of people say like the planet would kind of collapse. Certainly, the world as we know it, our dinner plates would look vastly different, and we'd kind of be we'd have just layers and layers of like organic material that would not be as readily broken down by those decomposing insects like beetles. So insects just provide a myriad of benefits that often go really overlooked by us.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Sawa Khan. I'm here today with Danae Wolf, who's a conservation educator, macro insect photographer, and author of a book entitled Grass Isn't Greener. We were talking earlier about grass and about lawns. I assume at one point that you were okay with lawns. How did you come to the conclusion that they're not so great?
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's interesting because, growing up, lawns were, it was just a normal part of my life. It's a very cultural thing. We look at this, weed-free, pest-free, highly manicured turf grass lawn as being almost a marker of kind of the American dream, the big house and the carpet of green grass out front, the perfectly manicured backyard where you can barbecue and play with your kids and whatnot. So that was the norm for me growing up. And I bought my first home really fresh out of college, and I'd studied, like I mentioned, environmental studies. So I was studying kind of ecology and how to just live more gently. So I kind of bought my first home with this understanding that I want to do things different. I want to put the native plants back into the landscape. But I'll be honest, I really didn't know the best approach. I was very young and I wasn't experienced as a gardener. And I didn't know plant species. I didn't know what to plant or where to plant it. And I'd like to think that I kind of wrote Grass Isn't Greener for myself 15 years ago. This was the book that I needed to kind of jumpstart my own sort of home practices because I was a little lost and I kind of bumbled my way through our first home. We eventually moved a few years later to a bigger landscape, which meant even more work. It meant even more land to kind of work with and think about evolving into this oasis for wildlife. I'm much more educated now. I know a lot more. We've implemented a lot of practices. We've planted a ton of plants. Not all of them have lived. Spoiler alert, sometimes that happens. But we've learned a lot along the way. And I think that's where it starts, is with like the spark of curiosity, asking the right questions, doing your research, and then just taking those first steps, even if they seem really small and not impactful, they're still steps in that right direction.
Wolf describes how she had to stop and observe what existed in her garden before making changes.
Here's the thing about my half acre. We have two great big mature pin oak trees in my front yard. We have another mature pin oak in the back, along with a diversity of other trees of varying sizes. Our yard is flanked by mature white pines. Well, oak trees cast a lot of shade. These are very big trees that cast a significant amount of shade, especially in our front yard. And, gardening in a way that was going to really foster like pollinators, like planting a prairie was out of the question. We have too much shade. We have some areas of sunlight, but my original, I think, vision, I had to really step away from that. I had to learn about my landscape. I had to identify, where can we reasonably plant the pollinator plants? Where would be the best spot for the vegetable garden that we knew we wanted to eventually have and finally installed a few years ago? What else should we be thinking about, and how do I need to adapt my own vision to work with the land instead of against it? So, what that meant for us was with these big pin oak trees, We knew that we wanted to leave the leaves. I have a whole chapter in the book about the importance of leaves in the landscape and why we should not, grab the leaf blower the first day of fall and start blowing all the leaves away and taking them to the landfill. Leaves are habitat. They also help contribute to a healthy soil ecosystem. They provide overwintering habitat for all different sorts of species, from insects and spiders to, little critters like mice, even snakes, will go into that leaf litter and be supported there. We wanted to leave the leaves, but we're also in a suburb that cares very deeply about turf grass landscape. So we've been able to kind of create these dedicated garden beds under the canopy of these oak trees where we rake our leaves into.
I love that you talk about leaves because that's one of the things I've done in our garden here. We live in Central Texas, and so our soil initially when we moved here was what they call caliche, largely, which is basically a sandy, rocky soil. And we've been laying out tons of leaves over the years we've been here, and now have really beautiful deep soil. So.
I was going to say, one of the best things to do, we talk about the importance of that soil because soil obviously is the foundation of healthy plants. And leaves, like we tend to think about leaves as like beneficial for the habitat that they provide, which is absolutely true, but it also contributes to a healthy soil structure. So here in Ohio, we have a lot of areas with very like dense, heavy clay soil. And I'm like, just leave your tree leaves, right? Over time, they will decompose. They'll create this very rich, like more loamy soil structure. And that's going to, allow for nutrient availability. It's going to allow the water, to come through and reach your plant roots and air, all things that these plants need. And it's so simple, right? It should be so simple to leave the leaves. But again, we're so culturally tied to these perfectly manicured
Right.
lawns. So much of this is just moving away from this idea that like the dominant turf grass lawn is the marker of success. We have to redefine what beauty looks like and what we think and feel when we see these alternative habitats that are being really stewarded for wildlife and not for this human
Right.
aesthetic.
Why do you think lawns are so deeply ingrained in our culture, despite all the environmental downsides?
I think it's a lot of media influence. It's what we see all the time. Think about any movies that you see. You could think of like the intro to any movie in a neighborhood, and you have these aerial, panning shots. And what do you see? You don't see wildlife gardens. You don't see messy landscapes. You see these perfectly manicured turf grass lawns. It's reinforced by, in a suburb like the one that I live in, by having the lawn care companies or landscaping companies just line my street from this time of year through the fall months. Everybody's got their contractor out, everybody's leaf blowing and mowing. It's become not just a marker of like this sort of cultural norm, but it's become an expectation in a lot of neighborhoods, so much so that we actually have legislation in a lot of cities that prevent us from being able to garden in ways that support wildlife. We have legislation, built into things like city codes about not planting food in your front yard, which seems just so backwards when I think we break it down and really begin to ask ourselves, why is that? Why are we putting policies in place that prevent us from taking care of ourselves as a human species, and in ways that also prevent us from supporting wildlife and animals too? And then we just have like the neighborly expectations, right? The side eyes from your neighbors about why aren't you raking your leaves? Why are you letting the dandelions grow? Why is your landscape looks so messy. So it's really become a cultural norm and one that's difficult to move away from.
Right, so how do you change minds?
I think it's a lot of education. And I know that almost sounds like an easy, cop-out answer, like, oh, we just need to educate and hope that people come along. But, for me, this is where photography really comes into play. A lot of people, they see an insect or a spider, and you see it from kind of far away. It's scurrying on the floor or on your wall, and your immediate reaction is, oh, kill it, right? It's a bug, and all bugs are gross and bad, and we don't want to see them. Even when the bug is like outside in its natural habitat, like a bee buzzing through a garden, you see like the kids running away, like, oh my gosh, there's a bee or a wasp, and it's gonna sting me. I just think we have this very just this understanding that these are like bad things and that they need to be taken care of. And what we need to do is show people the alternative. For me, I've been able to use photography to zoom in to quite literally like these faces, these portraits of insects and other small critters, and tell their stories. Tell the stories about how they're cute, how they're colorful, how they're charismatic, how they're beneficial, and then start to create this larger connection to the ecosystem, right? What would a world without bees or wasps look like? You know, what would we be missing from our human lives? Beyond that, though, all of these creatures that I just mentioned have intrinsic value. Even if they didn't provide this huge benefit to us as humans, they have intrinsic value here on the planet, just like all living things do. So it's really helping people kind of thread that connection and understand the impact of how you're gardening, or how you're, you know, heavy-handedly managing your home landscape. What is that actually doing? Right? I've heard so many people, especially on social media, in defense of their turf grass lawns, say things like, "Well, it's my land. I can do with it what I please." Well, what you do on your land has massive consequences for areas outside your land, from runoff of fertilizers and pesticides, you know, that go into streams and rivers and kill wildlife and create dead zones, to the air pollution from, you know, our two-stroke leaf blowers and lawn mowers. Like, there are huge ramifications, and I think helping people see that through education and outreach and things like photography and things like this podcast right here, these are all really just, I think, a powerful alternative narrative.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Danae Wolf, conservation educator, macro insect photographer, and author of a book titled Grass Isn't Greener. So, for someone who wants to make changes to their yard but they feel overwhelmed, what are some steps they can take?
Yeah, step one is go easy on yourself, because we all have to start from somewhere. When I moved into our home 9 years ago, I wanted radical overnight change. I'm a little bit of an impatient person, so I wanted that change for myself, because I wanted to, you know, step out my front door and say like, "Oh, we did it. You know, look at what we've accomplished." But I also wanted to reduce, I mentioned those sort of side eyes from the neighbors, right? I wanted them to just sort of see that benefit. And what I've learned in the 9 years since is I'm in it for the long game, and I have to give myself grace. I have to give my landscape grace, and just all of these ecological connections that I'm working to rebuild. You know, it takes time. That said, even things that you do that are seemingly small, you know, we started by ripping out about a 10 foot by 10 foot section of turf grass, and we put native plants in that little area. And it seemed so small at the time, but that kick started. Now, you know, that one little 10 by 10 area has grown to almost a 500 square foot area now, where we've installed almost 600 native plants, in like the one strip in our front yard that gets enough sunlight for a pollinator garden, between the shades cast by those oak trees that I mentioned. You start small, right? Identify the characteristics of your landscape, your areas of sun and shade, your topography, your soil, and then begin to just kind of make a plan. And again, if it's one 10 foot by 10 foot section, or a 5 foot by 5 foot section, or a container of pollinator plants on your balcony or porch, that's still a step in the right direction.
Getting back to lawns, they are monocultures, and that in itself is a problem. Can you tell us why?
We should be avoiding monocultures because they do not provide resiliency in the ecosystem. So what we mean by resiliency is, imagine you have a forest that's made up of a singular species of tree, and then you have an invasive species, like maybe a wood-boring beetle, that comes in. It's introduced to a new geography, and it does really, really well. It does a little too well, and it begins to kill off those trees. And it kills off all the trees because they're all the same species, and that specific wood-boring beetle might just host or live on that particular tree species. Well, now you're left with nothing. You're left with a no longer a forest, or, you know, really just an ecosystem of a bunch of dead trees. When you have a forest or a grassland or any ecosystem, a home landscape, a garden that has a diversity of plant life, I talk about this in the book as being like a really well-stocked toolbox. You have a lot of different species that provide the same ecosystem functions. So if something happens to one of those species, let's say a pollinator that pollinates a specific type of flower, if something happens to that specific species of pollinator, there's going to be something else in the environment that can still pollinate that plant. A well-stocked toolbox is important if you're building a whole house. You're not going to be able to build a whole house with just a hammer. You're going to need a lot of different tools to do that. And it's the same for biodiversity. We need a lot of diversity of tools out there to ensure that our ecosystems can remain resilient and continue to thrive, right? So the more resiliency that we build out in the ecosystem now, the better we are preparing not only for the health of wildlife and these ecosystems, but also for the health of us as people too, because we rely on healthy ecosystems for the health of us, our families, our children. Healthy ecosystems are better at filtering water, filtering air, and providing food that we need for a growing global population. We depend on Earth to provide for us.
Now, you talk a lot about shifting perceptions. Why is that critical?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to this idea that turf grass lawns have traditionally been looked at as this marker of success. We need to begin to shift what that looks like. We need to begin to redefine what we think of as beautiful. For me, when I go out into my landscape and I see holes in leaves, for example, I don't panic. I think to myself, oh, I wonder what this provided food for or habitat for. And one example that happens every year, we planted a little eastern redbud in our front yard, and it's still a somewhat small tree. I think we planted it 5 or 6 years ago now. And every year I go out and I see these perfectly round carved holes in all of the leaves. Now, a lot of gardeners might go out there and again start to panic, like, oh my gosh, something is eating this, and we need to treat for it. And now I know it's a female leaf cutter bee that basically carved little blankets for her babies. And she used those to provision a nest where she is going to lay her eggs. And that's going to create the next generation of bees. But I think when you reframe the story in that way and you don't just see, oh, damage to my beautiful, tree, but you see, oh, hey, my tree provided shelter or sustenance for something out there in the ecosystem, it starts to reshape how we think about our home landscapes. We don't just need a bunch of sterile botanical statues by way of ornamental plants that aren't providing anything to the ecosystem. What we need are plants that are meant to be eaten, not just by we humans, that's obviously important too, but we need plants that are providing shelter and food for wildlife. We can and should be gardening and landscaping in a way that is a part of nature instead of distinctly apart from it, which has been, I think, historically, our approach. We have rendered ourselves very distinct from the natural world, and that has been very intentional, right? We think that we are kind of this superior species and that we can innovate our way out of any problem. And I don't know that I don't know that I think that way. I think that we, like I said, we depend upon the health of the planet for the health of ourselves, our children, the future. And we need to begin to understand that, and we need to go back to a way of really stewarding the landscape and recognizing the importance of the health of the planet for ourselves and our future.
Here's a tip. To find native plants, go to the Audubon Society's website and search for their native plant database. There, you can enter your email and zip code to find plants that will thrive in your region. You can also do a general search online or contact your local garden club. That's all for now. Thanks to our guest, Danae Wolf, conservation educator, photographer, and author of The Grass Isn't Greener. And thanks so much to you for listening. Our website is mothering-earth.com. Until next time, this is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.